Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's Wednesday, meaning it's Politics Day, and today I'm joined by a couple political analysts. Jeff Taylor is joining us by phone. He's a professor of political science at Dort College. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Emily. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, we're glad you're here. And in our AIM studio, Stefan Schmidt. He's a university professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, Emily. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Stefan.
So we're going to be talking this hour about what we know about President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet list so far, his plans for immediate executive actions once he's in office, and what level of cooperation he can expect from Congress. And we want you to join our conversation as well. We're going to play our six words or less game today. In six words or less, what's your reaction to President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks so far? You can email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can call us, join our conversation at 866-780-9100. So President-elect Donald Trump, he's chosen one out of 15 cabinet department heads so far. Senator of Alabama Jeff Sessions is Attorney General. He's also picked South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to be the next UN ambassador and Kansas Representative Mike Pompeo. These three nominations require Senate confirmation. And last week, he also chose Reince Priebus as White House Chief of Staff, Steve Bannon as Chief Strategist, and Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor. Let's first talk about Trump's latest appointment, Nikki Haley. What do we know about Nikki Haley so far? Stefan, do you want to start us off?
Well, I mean, Nikki Haley, like many other Republicans, didn't really like Donald Trump very much and said some nasty things about him. So what we know about Haley is that, she may be able to accommodate to Donald Trump, and he certainly, by receiving her and inviting her, is showing that it was all campaign stuff. We all fight with each other. Now I've got to put together a team of people that can perform and that is efficient and effective. And Nikki Haley has been a great governor. I mean, she's an immigrant family, has gone through all kinds of things in her state, from terrible flooding to race riots to Confederate flag to, many confrontations, which she handled very skillfully. And so I think most of us think that, if she were the ambassador to the United Nations, she would do a terrific job. That's not a job that requires you to have a lot of technical knowledge. It requires you to be a good manager and have good human relations skills, which she does.
And she doesn't have much foreign policy experience.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter for the job.
Absolutely doesn't matter. You don't want someone in there who's already frozen in place, right, and who has a fully formulated foreign policy perspective, like John Bolton, who, couldn't move an inch, couldn't get along with any country in the world, couldn't negotiate. And Donald Trump is the guy of the deals. And when you're making deals, you don't have to go in and know a lot about whatever the deal is. You just have to be able to get along with people and get them over on your side and then get them to meet you halfway. And I think she can do that.
Jeff, do you agree with that? And I'll add another question on. Do you think she'll be, confirmed by the Senate?
I agree completely with what Stefan just said. I think she's got social skills. She's got the political background that it takes to not only be in a governing position but in a negotiating position. I think she's going to be a good fit for that job. And I would expect that she wouldn't have any problems being confirmed. I don't think there's. I'm not aware of any big controversies, hanging over her head. I don't see why, even Democrats in the Senate wouldn't go along with that appointment. So, yeah, I would expect that she would be confirmed.
Mm-hmm. Now on to a more controversial pick, Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. He's a senator of Alabama. He's been selected by Mr. Trump. And we have, as far as controversy, in 1986, the Senate denied Sessions a federal judgeship during President Reagan's administration. There were allegations of racial prejudice from his former colleagues when he was a U.S. attorney. How much do you think this will come into play as the current Senate holds confirmation hearings? Stefan?
Well, certainly the Democrats will raise it. I want to remind your listeners, and you as well, Emily, that the opposition party always wants to stress the controversial aspects of appointees. So, you know, Barack Obama's Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, is viewed as being extremely biased and as having, you know, perhaps been responsible for sort of ignoring the emails of Hillary Clinton and not prosecuting her. Of course, that's maybe not the same as making racist remarks and so on. But the point is that very few people get into the confirmation process and are the pick of the existing president without having all kinds of opposition research and pushback from the other party. And I think that there will be some of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Jeff, I'm wondering, you know, what you think Jeff Sessions, if confirmed by the Senate, will kind of how he will conduct himself. I mean, Mr. Trump was campaigning a kind of a law and order platform. He praised stop and frisk policies. Do you think that Sessions will kind of continue that tough on crime outlook?
You know, I would expect that that would be the case. But on the other hand, like just this past week in the interview with the New York Times editorial board and some other things that he's indicated, I think Trump is showing a certain flexibility or pragmatism, as you might expect from a New York businessman and somebody who's known as a deal maker. So he's already publicly said that you know he's going to take another look at climate change. It looks like he may be rethinking his support for waterboarding, stepping back on from you know making a promise of going after Hillary Clinton with some kind of investigation. He's kind of walking that back as well. So I you know at this point I think it's premature to assume that we know exactly how all of these things are going to play out. I think with Sessions, what you see there is a rewarding of somebody who's a Trump loyalist, somebody who was the first U.S. senator, in fact, one of the only U.S. senators to get on board the Trump train early on. And I think this is what you see this reflected in his choices of who he wants to surround himself with. There's a mixture of kind of more pragmatic choices, reaching out to the more moderate wing of the party, but then you also see some of the conservative loyalists. So, you know, the appointment makes sense, and I agree with what Stefan said. When a loyalist of the new president coming in is picked, the opposing party is always going to find things that they disagree with, but that's the nature of politics, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm curious, you know, how Jeff Sessions, as Attorney General, might impact the drug war. This is something that has become less popular in the American public. And then we see President Obama just this week commuted the sentences of 79 federal inmates in for drug crimes. Do you think that type of commutation would continue under a President Trump and Jeff Sessions as potential attorney general?
I don't. I mean, I think that I don't know anything about the people that Obama pardoned. I mean, I assume they were not, you know, El Chapo Guzman type drug lords.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people have been arrested and thrown in jail for drug possessions that are part of a very harsh federal law and state enforcement as well of it. You know, I don't think that the Trump administration is going to go soft on drugs because it's a huge problem. And this is a more law and order directed administration. And I think his supporters who voted for him to be different from Obama are going to expect him to be different on a lot of things, including, you know, trade agreements, you know, immigration and so on. So if Donald Trump doesn't bring change, and remember, Barack Obama was elected only because of the word change in his campaign. Hillary Clinton was rejected in 2008 because voters didn't see any change coming from her. And Donald Trump was elected exactly for the same reason, because he promised to shake things up. And so he better, I think, come through with, you know, criminal justice and, as well as some of the other things.
It's Politics Day on River to River, and you can join our conversation as well. In six words or less, feel free to call in or tweet us. What's your reaction to President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks so far? You can tweet us at IPR Talk or give us a call, 866-780-9000. 9,100. So we have some kind of speculation here. The New York Times reported yesterday that a person close to the Trump transition team has said Ben Carson's likely to be chosen as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And an hour ago, Carson tweeted that an announcement is forthcoming about my role in helping to make America great again. Jeff, I'm curious, do you see Ben Carson in that role? I know he's been kind of floated for various cabinet appointments.
Yeah, early on there was talk of Health and Human Services, HHS, that as a possible cabinet post given his medical background or Secretary of Education. But it looks like Housing and Urban Development is probably where he's going to land. It was a few weeks ago that he had said that he thought he would do better by staying outside of the cabinet and acting as an advisor to Trump, not within the D.C. bubble. But it looks like he's rethought that, or Trump has convinced him to change his mind. So I would expect that that's probably going to be where he ends up. And I think, especially with the conservative Christian wing of the Republican Party, I think that would be a popular choice.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about cabinet picks this hour. For National Security Advisor, Trump has nominated Michael Flynn. He's not confirmed he doesn't need confirmation since he's not a member of the cabinet, but the National Security Advisor is, a gatekeeper for proposals from the State Department and the Pentagon. And he wrote a book called The Field of Fight, How We Can Win the Global War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies, where he emphasized the need to fight domestic terrorism. What type of kind of domestic fight against terrorism might we expect, Stephen?
Well, I mean, there are two different interpretations of Mike Flynn. One, he's a retired Army Lieutenant General. He was the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is a difficult, challenging job these days, and apparently executed it very well. And he believes that to call extreme Islamic radicals terrorists, and to use the word Islamic, and to be, fairly strong in trying to push back against that, is something that ought to be done, that the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton have been reluctant to use the word Islamic. So I think he's going to come down, the hammer is going to come down a little harder, and I think he's going to push a little harder. I really frankly doubt that you're going to have this registration of Muslims and, neighborhood Islamic surveillance teams and things like that. I mean, this guy... I'm not sure. We don't know, what these people are going to do. But I think he's just going to be a more assertive, executor of policy. And I think, again, Donald Trump was voted largely because he promised that he was going to deal more directly and effectively with terrorism. And why are we surprised that he picked someone who is going to be a little bit more focused and clear on how to fight terrorism? I don't think we should be surprised.
Do you sense a lot of surprise?
I sense a lot of surprise because the mainstream media, I'm not going to include you in that, okay, Emily? even though you clearly are part of the wonderful media. I give a lot of money to Iowa Public Radio. I love it. I'm telling people that for Thanksgiving, instead of wasting their money on a lot of food, they should send you a check so the station can expand. So here's the deal. I hear it from the mainstream media hyperventilating about Flynn and how he is going to be awful and he's going to target Muslims and so on. We'll have to see. I personally doubt it, and I'll tell you why I doubt it, and maybe Jeff agrees with me. Donald Trump is very smart. If you don't like him, he's also very abrasive. But he doesn't want to fail in his first four years, and so he is not going to pick people who are going to do stupid things that are going to essentially not make him a success in his first 4 years. I think Ben Carson's selection is also important, and I agree with the things that Jeff said, because he's an African-American. And, the first day when all of this began, the selection of a cabinet, I watched the cable channels, the usual ones, and they were all, again, going nuts because it wasn't a very diverse cabinet. Well, you know, it's a big cabinet, and there are a lot of positions besides the cabinet that have to be selected. And so far, we see women, we see probably a black candidate. We see some potentially moderate Republicans like Mitt Romney, who might end up being Secretary of State. So Donald Trump doesn't want to fail. And I think he needs to get a lot of good advice from Democrats as well as Republicans on how to succeed, because Americans don't want him to fail either.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. It's Politics Day. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Conrad in Sioux City is joining us, taking us back to the potential Senate confirmation of Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. What are your thoughts, Conrad?
My three words are filibuster Jeff Sessions. There's been a lot of progress made in the last 8 years, specifically with regard to how we approach drug addiction. There's been a strong tendency to get away from a purely punitive approach, recognize that treatment is better. Both Eric Holder, the former Attorney General, and President Obama were involved in that. Sessions, I think, would reverse all of that progress.
All right. Thanks for your call, Conrad. Jeff Taylor, would a filibuster of Jeff Sessions even be possible / successful?
No, I don't see that happening, because part of the irony is that the Democrats under Harry Reid in the Senate took that option off the table. I initially thought when Sessions was appointed, I thought, well, that's a risky move, mm-hmm. because I thought Democrats will filibuster that. But they, what was known as the nuclear option, they changed it when they were in control of the Senate to reserve the filibuster for appointees, if I remember correctly, just to Supreme Court justices.
Right.
So they took the cabinet off the table, which now is going to come back to haunt them, in the sense that that's not even an option now at this point. All he needs is a simple majority to pass, which I assume he's going to get. And you know, the other thing is, with the drug war at the federal level, it's interesting that neither Clinton nor Trump talked much at all about that on the campaign trail. It wasn't as though Clinton raised that as a major issue either, sentencing reform or, you know, legalization of marijuana or anything like that. I would expect that Sessions is more conservative on that, but I also think at the same time, the pragmatic part of Trump, I don't think that he's going to be a zealot on that any more than the average president has been. And I also think that he may be open to the argument from libertarians in his party, people like Rand Paul, that maybe that should, if not a personal choice issue, maybe it should be a states' rights issue where the states get to set drug policy instead of the federal government. So I think there is a possibility that the Trump administration might be open, at least in terms of marijuana, to maybe stepping back or continuing that kind of trend that Obama started.
Now, Emily, can I just respond quickly to Jeff?
Sure.
Okay. I agree with you, and I wanted to say to the caller that coming down hard on the suppliers of dangerous drugs to Americans is not a bad policy. We have not been coming down on the huge cartels that are killing and poisoning Americans. And it doesn't mean that you can't come down hard on the supply side and be very progressive on the treatment side and on the side of those who become addicted. You know, you can do both. And I think if I were recommending anything to Sessions or to Donald Trump, I mean, Sessions isn't the only one who's going to be involved in the, you know, in the issue of drugs. It's going to be Health and Human Services and all kinds of other agencies, including the Veterans Administration. I would say be hard on the suppliers who tend to be in other countries, in China, in Mexico, in Colombia, and other places. Be harder on them and make it harder for them to traffic that. And then be very much more aggressive in treating people and providing facilities and get them out of jail, which is you don't get treatment in jail much, and build more facilities to deal with that end.
Thank you so much for your call, Conrad. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. In the second half, we're going to be talking about you know, what you, what as a caller would like to see President-elect Donald Trump accomplish in his first 100 days of office. Coming up on a break soon, but I'd like to have Jeff and Stefan, you both respond to NPR's lead politics editor, who this morning on NPR said that Donald Trump's cabinet picks, he said it does start to sound like a bit of a team of rivals. You have someone like former, you know, Breitbart News executive Steve Bannon, and then you have, you know, some more traditional picks. Is this a team of rivals, Jeff?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a fair assessment. But I think, because yes, it is a mix more of Trump loyalists, but then also Republicans who openly opposed Trump during the primary season, at least thinking in terms of Haley. Reince Priebus, the National Committee Chair, didn't openly oppose him, but privately I think everybody knew he didn't want Trump as the nominee. If Romney gets picked for Secretary of State, that would be, you know, kind of a stunning reversal for both of those men. So I think you see a mixture that's going to surround Trump. But the thing I think to keep in mind is that, I think it makes sense because, again, Trump is a pragmatist. He has some core principles, I think, but he is a pragmatist. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing to keep in mind is I think he's going to be a fairly engaged president in terms of the broad outlines of policy, probably not micromanaging. But as kind of a general contractor of the administration, he's going to set the broad outlines that he's going to expect people to follow, and he's going to expect them to be loyal. So I think if Romney is Secretary of State, it's not as though this is going to be a Romney presidency where he does whatever he wants. I think he's going to be following Trump's at least broad directives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Stefan, we have about 30 seconds.
Sure, I'll do it. Emily, do you know what Abraham Lincoln's cabinet was called?
No.
It was called a strong team of rivals, because you could pit ideas against each other, and Lincoln could then understand what the different approaches were to solving problems and could make the decision as to which was the best. It's a wonderful way of organizing any organization, including a university or a corporation.
Interesting. A strong team of rivals, Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. If you want to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. What would you like to see Donald Trump accomplish in his first 100 days of office? What plans of his do you think should get priority? Again, you can join our conversation, 866-780-9100. I'm Emily Woodbury. I'm joined today by Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University and Jeff Taylor of Dort College. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the influence of the white nationalist movement in the second half. So stay tuned. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day, and today I'm joined by Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University and Jeff Taylor of Dort College. In the first half, we were asking you in six words or less what your reaction is to Donald Trump's cabinet picks so far. And we have this tweet from Jeff, lots of alt-right racist picks. And, of course, you know, this is a big discussion nowadays in the last week about white nationalists coming on the national scene. You know, last Politics Day, last Wednesday, we talked about Steve Bannon being chosen for Mr. Trump's chief strategist. And Bannon is a former executive of Breitbart News, a website being dubbed as the platform for the so-called alt-right, a movement with views that are widely seen as anti-Semitic and white supremacist. And Bannon's ties to the alt-right have prompted a lot of fears, combined with white supremacist groups coming out onto the national stage since Election Day. And in fact, we have a clip last Saturday. Richard B. Spencer spoke at the National Policy Institute, which describes itself as an independent organization dedicated to the heritage, identity, and future of people of European descent in the U.S. and around the world. During a 30-minute speech, he saluted his crowd with this.
Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
Also in that speech was this line.
White is to be a striver, a crusader, an explorer, and a conqueror. We build, we produce, we go upward. And we recognize the central lie of American race relations. We don't exploit other groups. We don't gain anything from their presence. They need us and not the other way around.
Again, that's Richard Spencer speaking. And in the past, he's called for, quote, peaceful ethnic cleansing. The president-elect Donald Trump, in his New York Times interview this week, has denounced the alt-right movement, saying he disavows and condemns them. But people are just hearing about this movement now, a lot of people. Jeff, are they right to be concerned that groups like the National Policy Institute will have more influence in Washington, D.C. from this point on?
I don't think they are, and I don't want to say anything against the listener who is concerned, because I don't think it's his fault that he's worried, because there was a narrative stirred up during the campaign from the Democrats, and the mainstream media helped retail that concern. But I think it's way overblown. The number of people who are hardcore racists and anti-Semites who voted for Trump, it's a tiny, tiny fraction of his support. I'd say it's less than 1%. And a group like Richard Spencer that he leads, I guess he had a couple hundred people in D.C. at this conference, it's very marginal, to the point where I've been, active at different times in the conservative side of politics. I had never heard of the guy. It's not as though he wields any great influence nationally or within the Republican Party, but he has glommed on to Trump as a way of trying to, raise his own profile and that of his group. And so I don't doubt that he's probably a Trump supporter. But that doesn't mean Trump is supporting him, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think somebody like David Duke, who's a marginal figure who had a little bit of fame 20, 30 years ago, the media raised his profile, acting kind of as a publicist for David Duke, and now acting as a publicist for this Richard Spencer, and the really vile things that they're saying, all for the sake of tarnishing Trump. But I don't think it's fair. And I don't think you're going to see people like that having any influence over what goes on within the administration.
Stefan, I'm curious to hear what you think, too, because Richard Spencer, who we just heard in that clip, he seems to think that he is going to have more influence. What would make him think that?
Delusional. He's believing the media. I think Jeff put it correctly here that, the media has been just hysterical about, the Trump campaign, then the Trump organization, and Donald Trump being alt-right and shifting the entire country into a kind of neo-Nazi environment. If Donald Trump wants to be not only a one-term president but a failed president, then he will, in fact, play along with these people, because there is no support for it. I mean, the people who voted for Donald Trump didn't vote for him because of the stuff that this guy is saying. The data is now coming in, and I know Jeff and I are analyzing it. They voted for him exclusively for kind of economic reasons and to get the country sort of moving from where it's been stagnating. There was not really all that much, of this sort of social engineering. And I think, unless I'm wrong, Trump is going to want to be successful, and he's got to reject all kinds of people and directions that are destructive to him. And by the way, I think you might be interested to know that Donald Trump is going to be in charge no matter who he appoints to the cabinet. And I think I remember Abraham Lincoln had a cabinet meeting where there was a unanimous vote outvoting him, and he closed the meeting by saying, 7 nays, 1 a, 1 I, and the ayes have it. In other words, it doesn't matter if the entire cabinet is going one direction. If the president thinks it should be going a different direction, that's where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Emily, can I add one more thing?
Sure. I
agree with what Stefan just said. And I also think that it's important to keep in mind that, like, this phrase alt-right, which was something that really just came up during the past year, in the context of a political campaign, which should make us a little bit suspicious, no matter which side of the aisle it's coming from, when something suddenly takes on a life of its own and is magnified, I think way out of proportion to their actual numbers, we ought to be a little bit skeptical of that, of how much of that is just, political campaign rhetoric and manipulation. With Steve Bannon specifically being appointed as strategist for Trump, I think that is what has gotten a lot of people worried. But when you to my knowledge, and I've been interested in this because I thought, well, you know, what is his connection with the alt-right and all of that? It's coming out of one interview that he gave, I don't know if it was Vanity Fair, some kind of publication, where he said that Breitbart, which he had headed at the time editorially, was a platform for the alt-right. But I've never seen that quote put into context. That's one sentence pulled out. But I gather, reading the whole story, that Bannon was not defining the alt-right in the same way that Richard Spencer is defining it. He was saying it's much broader than that. It's an alternative to kind of the GOP establishment in D.C., but he viewed the white supremacists as a tiny fraction on the fringe of the alt-right. So I think part of it is how you define the term. And the other thing is that if you read Bannon's recent interview with The Hollywood Reporter, it's worth reading because he very explicitly says, I'm not a white supremacist, I'm not a white nationalist, I'm an economic nationalist. And I think that kind of nationalist and populist message is exactly what appealed to the working class voters in a lot of those swing states. And Stefan mentioned that was driving, I think, at least a large portion of the support for Trump. So I don't think it has anything to do with race in his mind. It's much more economics.
Talking politics this hour on River to River, you can join our conversation by calling 866-780-9100. Again, that number is 866-780-9100. Moving on to the president-elect's relationship with the press. It was often strained during the campaign. So kind of looking forward, this week Donald Trump canceled an interview with the New York Times last minute, but after some back and forth, he agreed to an off-the-record meeting with Times executives, as well as an on-the-record interview with reporters and editors. We have some tape from the on-the-record interview. While there, he had something to say about his relationship with the press.
It's well out there that I've been treated extremely unfairly, in a sense, in a true sense. I wouldn't only complain about the Times. I would say the Times was about the roughest of all. You could make the case the Washington Post was bad, but every once in a while I'd actually get a good article. not often, dear, but every once in a while. So,
now, Trump's transition team has not instituted a formal protective press pool. What do you anticipate will be the role of a Trump press pool? Will they have as much access as they've had in the former administration, Stefan?
No, they won't. I mean, Donald Trump knows that the purpose of the media is to generate headlines and hits and clicks and drive up essentially the price of advertising on their networks and on their websites and so on. And that's not a terribly great way to report information. And I think what Donald Trump has discovered is that you don't need the media. You can go around it. The media will report what you tweet, and then that becomes the news. And that's much more effective than essentially having a lot of reporters who don't like you, by the way, because those reporters, for almost every single one of them, was opposed to Donald Trump, was shocked that he won the nomination, and appalled that he became president. So they're not an objective, friendly news media. Ronald Reagan, I did a radio show this morning for a different network, I reminded the host that Ronald Reagan also bypassed both Congress and, to a large extent, the media by going directly to the American voters and having press conferences, not with reporters, but basically giving a speech to the American people and saying, this is what we need to do. I want you to help me get this done. This is the right way. Contact your members of Congress and we can get it done. And I think Donald Trump is going to be very much more like that than reporters who presidents who have a lot of press conferences. You know, Barack Obama didn't have a lot of press conferences. He basically sent out his press secretary to, you know, blow some hot air at the media, but he didn't have a lot of press conferences. He was not a very accessible president. And I think Donald Trump is going to do it in a very, very different style, and that's going to be very annoying to the news media.
I mean, there are things too that I hadn't even thought of. You know, I was talking with a fellow reporter the other day, and they said, you know, with him going out to dinner with his family without the press pool, what if something happened? What if, you know, God forbid there was an assassination? No one would be there to cover it.
Well, I think there would be. I mean, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You can tell your friend or reporter that if something were to happen to Donald Trump while he's eating at a fancy restaurant, nobody would know about it. It's just ludicrous. It's just that there wouldn't maybe be an official reporter there, but there certainly would be a lot of people with iPhones and, you know, ways of recording it. I think we're so frozen in place in terms of how a president should do everything that he does that when someone doesn't do it that way, we freak out. And I think maybe it's a good thing that we have someone who's not going to do things the way they've always been done, because that hasn't always been all that wonderful. So, you know, having his family living in New York and him living in the White House, maybe that's, you know, the wave of the future.
Jeff, I'd like to have you comment on an interesting part of that New York Times interview. When asked, you know, about his plans to prosecute Hillary Clinton, you know, on the campaign trail, his supporters would chant, "Lock her up." He said, "This isn't something that I feel very strongly about," and that he doesn't want to hurt the Clintons. Do you think this is a strategic move to not be seen trying to prosecute his former political rival?
I think it's both strategic and it is smart politics, because you know, as Stefan pointed out, the media, by and large, from the reporter level up to the, you know, editorial and ownership level, has been very hostile to Trump, and of course they would brand that a witch hunt, and that you know, I'd seen references to this during the campaign. It'd be like a banana republic if the winner tried to jail the loser, and so on. And so I think he knows it wouldn't play well in the media and with, you know, almost about half the country, or at least half the country that voted. So I think it's a strategic move. But I also think on a personal level, maybe when he's winning, Trump is more magnanimous than we thought or gave him credit for being. We know that he's very thin-skinned, and we know that when he's losing or on the defensive, that he can be quite personal. But maybe he thinks at this point, let it go. I mean, I think even socially, he and Bill Clinton, I think, had a friendship. They were golf partners, at least, at times. And I think, so on that level, maybe he feels like she has suffered enough. I also think it doesn't take the possibility of legal action off the table. It's probably a smart move in that way. If down the road the FBI uncovers illegalities with the Clinton Foundation, and there's apparently an ongoing investigation into that, if they would recommend to the Justice Department some kind of prosecution or you know, grand jury, Trump would have his hands clean in that sense, that he wasn't seen as being the person driving this for political reasons.
We have another clip from the president-elect's interview with the New York Times. Trump went on to discuss the potential conflict of interest between his business and his presidency.
In theory, I could be president of the United States and run my business 100%, sign checks in my business. I could run my business perfectly and then run the country perfectly. And there's never been a case like this where somebody's had, like, if you look at other people of wealth, they didn't have this kind of asset and this kind of wealth, frankly. You know, it's just a different thing. But there is no, I assumed that you'd have to set up some type of trust or whatever, and you don't. And I was actually a little bit surprised to see it. So in theory, I don't have to do anything. But I would like to do something. I would like to try and formalize something, because I don't care about my business. So I don't have to do anything, but I want to do something if I can.
So we hear him saying there's never been a case like this. Has there never been a case like this? Is this an unprecedented situation for a president to also have business dealings going into the office?
Well, this is Stefan. I guess I can't really think exactly of, you know, what other very wealthy presidents like Franklin Delano Roosevelt or others, you know, might have had to put things in a blind trust. I'm not sure he did. It's astonishing. There is no law. The media began immediately to say, you know, that he's required to do that. But there is no law that requires a president to set up a blind trust, in fact. So if you want that done, let's, you know, pass a law, amend the Constitution, or do something else. And I think Donald Trump, again, is proving to be unpredictable and incomprehensible, throwing everyone off balance in the same way that he was saying, well, there's no law that requires presidential candidates to release their income tax returns. And in my case, I've got so many business dealings and, you know, those are all proprietary. And so I'm not going to release my income taxes. And he became president without doing that. So I think we're seeing challenges in a time of great disruption. And I think Jeff will agree that this is a time of great disruption. And Donald Trump is doing that. By the way, Jeff is the best person to predict the future, because how could someone know that Bob Dylan was going to get the Nobel Prize? Because Jeff wrote this book called The Political World of Bob Dylan, I think back in 2015 or something.
Yes.
So congratulations, Jeff. You're visionary, that's for sure.
Thank you. Yes, I can't really take credit for being a prophet, but it was a happy turn of events for me.
Is that book still in print?
It is. You know, I'm hoping that...
All right. Now it's going to sell out.
Well, it would if it wasn't in hardcover by an academic press. So it's priced really high. I'm hoping that Palgrave Macmillan will put it out in paperback.
Yeah, they should. And they should advertise it, because that's wonderful.
Well, Jeff, as our resident fortune teller is your new title, let's talk about the future of the Democratic Party. You know, one of the first big decisions the party was going to make heading into a new administration is who will be its next formal leader. And there's a lot of speculation right now on who may be considered. They're electing the new DNC chair in February. Do you have any predictions?
You know, from what I've heard, I think Howard Dean, the former Vermont governor and presidential contender at one point, he would like the job back. He was DNC chair for a while, and he would like it back. And then Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota, out of the Minneapolis area, is also running, and he is African American. He's Muslim as well in his religion, and I have heard that Ellison, he was a Sanders supporter. And he's younger, and so, you know, if the Democrats wanted to go in a more progressive kind of fresh face approach, they could go with Ellison. But then I've also been reading that at one point he made some comments about 9/11 that were videotaped, and it looked like he was saying that 9/11 was some kind of an inside job, or that Jews benefited from it, and all that. I was curious about that, so I watched that clip last night, and it's actually I think a misinterpretation of what was said. He was asked a question by someone who benefited, and they're translating that as Jews benefited. And then when Ellison agreed, they said, we gotcha. I think he was really saying that the Bush administration benefited, that they were able to kind of take a draconian approach in blaming Muslims and pursuing a foreign policy that was more aggressive in the Middle East. So, but he's got some baggage because of that. And I think the party leadership wouldn't want someone like Ellison just because he's too much of a purist in his ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stephen, briefly, do you
have
any
predictions? Yeah, there's also Martin O'Malley, the former Maryland governor, who is being looked at by some. And then Tomas Perez, the labor secretary, who is liberal, is a Hispanic, is a very, very tough and extremely focused individual. I actually ran into him one time when he was doing a labor deal down there in Florida somewhere. And boy, that guy can look you in the eye and you will say, yes, sir, what do you want me to do? So I wouldn't, you know, put it past. My own personal opinion is that Ellison is just not a very good choice, because the Democrats didn't have a problem with minorities. They had a problem, actually, with a lot of white voters, and the Democratic Party lost a huge chunk of that. So if they once again go, you know, for basically ethnic politics, I think it's not going to help very much.
All right, lightning round question. Jeff, Stephen, will you be talking politics at the Thanksgiving table tomorrow?
Yes, I will.
How about you, Jeff?
We're going to try to avoid it.
I think you're in the camp of a lot of Americans. Well, Stephen, Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Emily. Great show.
Stephen Schmidt, a university professor at Iowa State University. Jeff Taylor, a professor at Dort College. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury. Thanks for joining us.